This podcast is about your future. What if the next years of your life can be the best years of your life? When full-time work becomes optional, you'll have the time to do all the things you've always wanted to do, if only you had the time. And soon you will. But to make the most of it, you'll need to be well prepared, and that goes well beyond your financial planning. Each week, your host, Joe Casey, is inviting you into conversations with his guests to bring you insights, inspiration, and practical ideas to design your new life, a life you'll build around what matters most to you and on your own terms. Let's get started.
Are you moving less than you used to? Well, you're not alone. There were a lot of reasons why. Technology makes things so much easier for us, so convenient. Work is less physical than it was in the old days for many people. And the pandemic. But things are on the upswing and spring is here. So it's a great time to be thinking about how can you get more movement into your everyday life. And we have a guest today who will explain the science behind exactly why that's a wise move. Caroline Williams is the author of the book Move, How the New Science of Body Movement Can Set Your Mind Free. Caroline is a science journalist and editor. She's also a consultant for and regular contributor to New Scientist. Her written work has also appeared in The Guardian, my hometown newspaper, The Boston Globe, BBC Future, and BBC Earth, among others. She has worked as a radio producer and reporter for BBC Radio, and was the regular co-host of the New Scientist podcast. She is the author of another book, Override, My Quest to Go Beyond Brain Training and Take Control of My Mind, which was published in the U.S. as My Plastic Brain. She was also the editor of the New Scientist Instant Expert Guide to the Brain. She holds a bachelor's in science in biological sciences from Exeter University and a master's in science with distinction in science communication from Imperial College London. Caroline, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So I really enjoyed reading your book, so much so that I also read the acknowledgments. And you mentioned long, ponderous dog walks in the acknowledgments. How did they lead to this book?
So I have a very, very boisterous, very active dog that's bred to run up and down the mountains of New Zealand barking at sheep for 14 hours straight. So he takes a lot of walking. So I don't really have any choice about the long walks bit. But I have found over the years, you know, I've been a writer a really long time and I've spent a lot of time sitting at my desk trying to think of ideas. I sort of gradually realized over the years that the time when I come up with my best ideas, and also if I get stuck on something and I can't think how to write something clearly and explain it something clearly, that the best thing I can do is just down tools and go for a walk. And usually about halfway or three quarters of the way into a long walk, sort of I have a eureka moment and I think, oh, this is amazing. And so I spend a lot of time sort of tapping things into my phone as I'm walking and then emailing things to myself as I'm going along, which sometimes don't make sense when I get home. But yeah, so it was one of those walks that I started thinking, you know, I was thinking vaguely about body-mind connections and how a movement can affect the way we think and feel. And I was thinking how to approach that in articles and hopefully a book. And it really was during lots of long walks that it started to sort of coalesce into, well, this helps me. So I wonder if there's any science behind that. And I sort of started looking when I came back from my walk to see if there's any research. And it turned out absolutely loads is out there.
And you also walked on a thinking path that someone in history had also done some of his best thinking.
Yeah. So, I mean, I definitely can't claim to have invented walking and thinking. You know, the best thinkers of time have sort of walked and thought and come up with great ideas. And so one of those people is Charles Darwin. And so I love this story because what happened when he did his voyages of the Beagle, he had all these data points that would later he would use to support his theory of evolution. But he came back from his voyages, the Galapagos Islands of the voyages of the Beagle, and he had this idea about the web of life, that things were connected, but he couldn't quite nail it down into this sort of coherent account. And he was living at the time in London where he was well known, people were always dropping in, he had a growing family that were just making loads of noise. And his way of dealing with that was to move away from London. So he moved to the Kent countryside, which is close to London, but lovely and green. And when he got there, he built what he later called his thinking path, which is a quarter of a mile loop around the grounds of his house. And it's lovely. You can visit it in the UK. It's a place called Down House in Kent. And this path, it's a gravel path. It goes along the side of a rolling meadow. And then it gets to the end of the path and it loops back around through some dark woodland. And Darwin would walk four or five loops of this once a day. And he would just mull things over. And he would get so lost in his thoughts that he would have to keep a tally of how many loops he'd done. And the way he did this was he'd put a little stack of stones at the start of the loop. And every time he went past them, he would kick one off or knock one off with his walking stick when he got a bit older. And part of the story I really love is that his children used to come along and just to annoy him, they would add or take away stones so he'd get confused about how many loops he'd made. But I mean, that was where his sort of ponderous walks around and around was sort of where he got the headspace to come up and put together these little bits and pieces of his theory. And that's what we have today. So, and we know since then that studies of what happens to the brain when we're walking or moving at an easy pace is that the prefrontal cortex, which is the brain behind the eyebrows, activity in that part of the brain gets turned down temporarily when we are moving forward at an easy pace. And that's been shown in other studies to be the best sort of state to be in for creative ideas. So for that exact problem that Darwin had, taking ideas from all over the place and bringing them together into a coherent thread. So I found that really, really interesting. It's a really simple way that most people can do to use your movements to affect the way that you can think.
A lot of advantages. And you cite a number of compelling stats on how sedentary people have become. And it goes back before the pandemic. And what's behind those trends?
Yeah, I mean, we've steadily been sort of declining into our seats for quite a while. You know, even just looking to the 60s, we're significantly more sedentary now than we were then. And part of it, I guess, is we do less physical jobs. You know, there's more sitting around involved. But also, I think all this technology that's come along, we've basically engineered a world for ourselves where you don't have to move to survive. You can order your food in, you can, I mean, if you're interested in dating, you can date online and find your life partner without leaving your chair. There's pretty much nothing you can't do from the comfort of a chair. And so I think even though as human animals, we are built to move, there's also a little bit of a glitch in the system whereby we also evolved to conserve energy whenever we could. It's because we didn't know where the next meal was coming from back on the plains. So it's comfortable. It feels good to rest. And so as a result, we don't have to move, so we don't. So we're sort of our own worst enemies in a way.
And so what are some of the consequences of this less active lifestyle?
Yeah, well, it surprised me actually just how broad the consequences are. So, you know, we all know about the physical fitness, and everyone knows already that physical exercise is good at lifts your mood, endorphins, blah, blah, blah. But there's more to it than that. And so because of the way that our bodies and brains are set up so that movement, when we're physically active, our brains invest in capacity. So they add more neurons, they have more connections between those neurons, more blood vessels. Everything just works a bit better. And so there's some evidence coming through that when people are in the space of their own lifetime, people who are less active have more cognitive decline, more decline in the health of their brain than people who are more physically active. And that can be sort of picked up on IQ tests over a lifetime. You know, the decline is faster. Also, there's evidence at a population level. For a long time, IQ at the population level was rising and rising and rising. And, you know, this was thought to be because of better education, better nutrition, all this kind of that stuff. But then from about the year 2000 or so, that trend has been slowing down and it's been starting to reverse and go into the other direction. And it's possible that is somehow linked to our sedentary lifestyles. I mean, there's probably more than one thing going on. But sedentary lifestyles have been linked to IQ declines, to a loss of creativity for the reasons I've been talking about in Darwin, and that, you know, getting our brains into the right state of mind, to antisocial behavior, to anxiety and depression. You know, there's a lot of things tied up in our sedentary lifestyles that we could quite easily change. So there's a lot of reasons to move more.
It explains a lot of what we've been seeing. and with a different angle on it. So one stat that jumped out to me in your book was that only 17% of people go for walks regularly. And sadly, of course, some people can't, but most of us can. Mm-hmm. What did you learn about walking in your research?
Yeah, so walking's a really interesting one because it's such a simple thing. And you might think, well, you know, who needs to be told how to walk? But there are various ways of doing it, and they seem to have different impacts. So we've already talked about the slow, mind-wandering walk, and that's been shown to be a really good for creativity and thinking outside the box. There's also really interesting research about when we sort of go for a more brisk, pounding walk. And there was this really interesting researcher called Dick Green that I came across. And he's been researching what happens when we put weight onto the soles of our feet and walk. And obviously what happens is you get some compression on the soles of your feet. And that does something to the blood flow in our legs. And it adds a little bit of a whoosh of blood to the brain. So when you're up and moving on your feet, you do get an extra boost of something like 15% of blood to your brain. But he found, even more interestingly, there's this little sweet spot where if you walk at 120 steps per minute and your heart is beating at 120 beats per minute, the heartbeat and the footsteps synchronize. And that gives a significant boost on top of what you already get just from walking to your brain. And he speculates that maybe that's why you get this great feel-good factor from walking. And that's quite a brisk walk. 120 beats per minute is quite difficult to keep up for long. But the easy way to do it, I found, is to put some music on that has a beat at 120 beats per minute. And it just so happens that that's the most common beat in Western pop music. So that if you Google it, 120 beats per minute songs and the genre of music, you will find something that you like that you can put on your headphones and just march along to that. And that will give you, you know, if you're feeling lethargic, I often find this, if I'm sitting at my desk too much, feeling lethargic, go out and go for a really good brisk stomp. And that can get a boost of blood to the brain, bring back some focus, bring back a bit of vitality and energy. So that's a different way of using the same thing to change your state of mind. And the final way that I found of using walking was very simple. And it actually doesn't have to just be walking. It could be any way of moving forward through space. So there were some really interesting psychology experiments that I came across that found that when people are physically moving forward through space, walking in their studies, that it does something to our perception of time. So most of us think of the past as being behind our backs and the future being ahead of our chests. As we're moving forward through that space, it seems to have this spillover effect that we feel as if we're moving into the future and, you know, we're walking towards hopeful, good things and away from things that happened in the past and you might want to leave behind. And I found this was a really compelling thing to do. It really struck home to me during the pandemic when, one point in the UK, we were only allowed out for 1 hour once a day, and we would go for a walk or for a bike ride. And no matter how cooped up we were feeling at the time, it always, always got us feeling more hopeful and like we were able to get through this somehow. So it seems to be like a part of our psychology that moving forward is something that makes us feel good, makes us feel hopeful. And it's relevant to things like depression, where people tend to get stuck ruminating in loops of negative thoughts, and just breaking that by moving forward might be a really simple way of helping that.
Very helpful. I'm just picturing my neighbor's reaction when they see me strolling along at a faster clip, powered by my 120 beats per minute pop songs.
Yeah, do it. Yeah, I mean, you'll be feeling great. So you won't care what they think.
Absolutely. A lot of your book is about the mind-body connection, as you mentioned, but I noticed in it you refer to it as the body-mind connection. Which do you think it is? Who's driving the bus?
That's an interesting question, because I think the way that it's been thought about for a really long time, and I've spent 20 odd years looking into various ways of explaining why humans think the way we do and why we feel the way we do, and ways of sort of manipulating that, improving it, if you will. And for a lot of that time, the idea has been that the brain is the controller. The brain tells everything else what to do, and that our body is kind of a meat suit that carries us around and sort of enacts that. But things are changing a bit. I mean, obviously the brain is very, very important. It's a very complex, it's the most complex object in the known universe. You know, it's very, very important. But its role is beginning to be rethought a little bit, so that rather than the body just being something that responds, that messages coming from the body come into the brain. And sort of you can think of the brain rather than being the boss, rather being a sort of facilitator that listens to everybody, the hormonal messages in the blood, the nerve messages coming from the body, you know, all these different inputs. And then it's sort of the brain is the facilitator that then listens to all these inputs and decides collectively what to do. So it's more of a, it's not necessarily mind to body or body to mind. It's kind of a circular thing, body, mind, it's all going on. And I think what's really interesting is that we can now understand how doing certain things with the body can change the messages that are going to the brain and change that whole conversation with the facilitator for the better. So you can update that information and use your body almost as a tool to try and make different decisions and to feel a different way. So that's, I think, where I see the main change going.
So what do you personally do differently now because of what you learned in writing the book?
Well, I've always been very fidgety, so it's kind of given me a license to move around as much as I want to. One thing I do, I mean, because obviously writing and editing and involves a lot of sitting, so I mix it up. So sometimes I sit here at my desk, on my chair, I'll go downstairs, I'll sort of sit in a straddle shape and I'll sit there, get a bit of a stretch in on my lower back. I might, you know, do a few squats, put my laptop on a chair in front of me and squat in front of it for as long as my knees will allow me to. Just generally build movement into the day more, you know, and when I'm really fed up, just a 5-minute blast of some music and a dance around the kitchen does wonders. So it's almost given me the reason to do all the things that maybe I would want to do, but would think, oh no, I better not because I should be working. And also I think one thing, because I know and understand the links between walking and thinking, you know, that's the biggest thing. Even though I've been working for myself for 20 odd years, it still felt a little bit like skiving off to go for a walk when I'm supposed to be working. Whereas now I think of it differently. I think, well, that is work. It's just a different way of working. And actually, it might be more productive if I go and do that than if I sit here banging my head off the desk for the next hour. So yeah, there's been a few changes. It's more of a change of mindset and allowing myself to do what my body really wants. And I think I'm a bit more in tune with what my body wants, whether it wants a rest, whether it wants me to jump around, whether it wants a stretch. Yeah, so a license to fidget, I think, is the main change in my life.
Research made me do it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Science says.
So I'm firmly in the 93% of Americans that you noted in your book who don't dance for fun. Tell us a bit about your experience learning about dancing in your research.
Yeah, dance is really fascinating. And I could have written a whole book on dance. I got very carried away with this chapter. I had to hack it back quite significantly. And other people, by the way, have written books just about dance and what it does to our psychology. So there are many reasons why humans dance. And you think about it, we are about the only species that dances. And so there's lots of theories about why that is. And one idea is that it helps us to, that in our evolution, that it helped us to bond as a society, as a group of people. Because when we were sort of hunting, gathering, we really relied on each other. Humans aren't very strong. We're not very fast. You know, what we do have is social bonds. We work together and we have our brains. So this might be connected. So one of the things that backs this up is some studies that show when you're moving in synchrony with somebody. So when you're moving your body, you have this sense of proprioception, which tells you where your body is in space. And it's a sort of unconscious sense. So you don't need to look down. You know where your body is. When we're moving in synchrony with somebody else, we're also getting information through our eyes about where their body is in space. And when their movements are matching our movements, our brain gets a little bit confused. And sort of the line between us and them gets a little bit blurred. And one idea is that because of this blurring between, you know, what's me and what's you, we start to feel more connected. And there's lots of studies that have shown that when people have been moving in synchrony with each other, they do care about each other more. And if you get them to play competitive games, they'll work together more effectively, even toddlers. So they've done experiments where they bounce little toddlers on your knee in time to the music. And then if you put them down and you accidentally drop something, the little toddler is far more likely to pick it up and hand it back to you if you've been bouncing them in synchrony than if you've been doing it all over the place. So it seems to be hardwired into our biology that moving together makes us care about each other. And so given that, you know, we're so lonely, you know, there's this loneliness epidemic that's going on, even though we're more connected than we've ever been, you know, in theory, online, just moving together, however that is, whether it's aerobics, yoga, dancing, Tai Chi, doesn't matter, just moving with other human beings is something that really can make us feel a lot better. The good news for that, if you're not a natural dancer, is that when you're moving in time to music, I was speaking to a neuroscientist called Peter Janata, who's a really interesting guy. And he said, you know, he doesn't really like to dance, but he sort of grooves along to music. And he says, you know, when you're moving in time to music that's made by other human beings and the movements of their bodies, it's like having an invitation to join in with the band. So you're sort of moving along with the movements that they're making to make those noises. And so you can have this sensation and this feeling of being part of something that's bigger than yourself, even if you're just kind of, you know, nodding along quietly in the corner somewhere, or even if you're jumping around to music all by yourself, which is what I do quite a lot in the kitchen. So yeah, it's an easy way to feel good. And also if you really go for it, and I had experience of this in sort of freeform dance class that I attended, and I opened the book with this story, it was just really embarrassing. But when I let myself go and went really with the beat, you can get catapulted into this altered state of consciousness where you're sort of not thinking, you're just being. And that's one way to just escape all the stresses of life, and it can just take you out of yourself. And that's a really amazing thing that dance can do to change the way that you're feeling at any one time.
So we were talking before we started recording, and I shared that sometimes I learn some things the hard way. I prefer to learn through research, but sometimes hard way is the way to go. And as a runner, I learned how important stretching is the hard way. Mm-hmm. How does stretching and yoga help us?
Yeah, so stretching was a very interesting one as well, because you think of it as being to do with releasing tight muscles, and that is a part of it. So there's this reflex that a lot of animals have that we also have, you know, when you stretch and yawn and you kind of like, it almost feels like you're out of control. It's kind of not quite a conscious reaction. It's kind of releasing the body from a state of tension when you've been sitting for too long, and your body knows it wants it. You can see every cat and dog doing it. And that's one really simple way to change the way you're feeling if you've been sitting down for a long time. But past that, deliberately stretching, yes, it releases tension from the muscles, but there's another tissue that gets overlooked quite a lot, which is the fascia, which is sort of the covering. If you were to dissect the human body, it would look like sort of white, sticky, gloopy, horrible stuff that wraps your muscles, and it's under the skin. It's basically everywhere in the body, because it gets in the way and it's horrible and sticky. Anatomists have just long sort of scraped it off, chucked it in the bin, and then made their nice drawings of the human body. Well, now it's starting to be looked at more closely. And we know that this is a biologically active tissue. And stretching seems to do something specific to it. So within this tissue, there are cells called fibroblasts, and they sort of make the collagen and the elastin and all the other fibers that make up this sort of very strong, stretchy tissue. And when that tissue is stretched, these cells get pulled longer and flatter. And when they do that, they secrete compounds that are linked to reducing inflammation. So in lots and lots of studies have shown that if you have an injury and it's stretched, you know, it can heal more quickly if that has been stretched. Where this comes into the mind-body-mind connection is that inflammation, chronic inflammation, is a consequence of stress, and it's a cause and a consequence of stress. And it's been linked to pretty much everything that ails modern society. So everything from heart disease, diabetes, obesity, everything is sort of like got some kind of inflammation component. And if by stretching these tissues, what it seems to do is it sort of also, as well as releasing anti-inflammatory molecules, it sort of squeezes this tissue, which is like a sponge shape, squeezes it into the lymphatic system, which is part of the immune system, and everything gets a little bit of a clear out. So this is something that I'd heard over many years doing yoga, and I always used to slightly roll my eyes about it. You know, a yoga teacher would say, oh, wring the toxins out of your tissues. And I'd think, oh, seriously, come on. I know it feels like that, but that can't really be happening. But it seems that there is some truth in that, because this fluid, it's got a lot of liquid in it, and it drains into the lymphatic system. So yeah, we're wringing the toxins out. We're maybe moving things along. What the body's doing is sort of moving all this fluid along where the body can deal with it. So if there's any problems in the immune system, it can deal with it and then damp down that immune system response, making us go back to health. Because one of the problems with inflammation is that it's chronic. The body needs a switch to turn it off. And there's some evidence that this stretching might provide some of that switch to turn this inflammation reaction off. And yeah, it's a very, very simple way to just, I think of it as clean. I hate to say like cleaning out the system and rinsing out toxins and things like that, but it's sort of, that's this sort of general idea that we're thinking of. So it's a tissue that's often neglected. And yeah, stretching and yoga are a very interesting bit of research into how we can keep these tissues more healthy.
One of the most important things I've learned is to always listen to your yoga instructor.
Yeah, the other thing that I used to say that I used to roll my eyes at was give your organs a massage. And I think, well, if the body's organs needed a massage, why would they bother putting big bony cages around them? You know, they're well protected for a reason. But actually, when you think about the squeezing and moving along of fluids and immune reactions going on in that tissue, then it starts to sound a bit less far-fetched, and that maybe you don't necessarily need to get your leg behind your head. It's just maybe just moving and stretching and moving these tissues around, whether that's just through any other kind of movement or something more formalized like yoga, then it starts to make a bit more sense. Maybe our bodies do need movement to keep all these tissues healthy.
So there are some simple things we know we should attend to, but we may not. What should we know about posture and smiling?
Yeah, posture is a very interesting one. It's an area of research that's been quite controversial. So I think a lot of people may have seen Amy Cuddy's TED Talk. It was one of the most watched TED Talks. Yeah, the power posing, standing up straight. And I mean, personally, I think Amy Cuddy got a bit of a bad rap because her study is one of many that have shown that having an upright posture does sort of lead to feeling more capable, more powerful, and just more confident. And that's been shown time and time and time again. What happened with that study that then didn't get replicated was that the link with an increase in testosterone and a decrease in cortisol, which is the stress hormone. So it's a slight situation of the baby being thrown out with the bathwater. So, you know, the short answer of that whole debacle was that, yes, upright posture does seem to make you feel better, but it may not be the hormones after all. And there's some new research that I came across, which is really interesting, which was to do with tracing the neural pathway, so the wiring diagram of the body from the adrenal glands, which are right on top of the kidneys, and following them back to the brain to see where they ended up. So what's connected to this fight or flight response? And when they traced those pathways back to the brain, they turned up in an area of the brain, the motor cortex, which does voluntary movements. And it's sort of like an Alice band across the top of your head. And different areas of that brain region correspond to different parts of the body. Where most of these nerve endings ended up was in a part of the motor cortex that controls movements of the core muscles, the trunk muscles, which are the ones that control our posture. So there seems to be something about movement in general and movement of the core in particular that has some regulatory function on the fight or flight system, so the stress system, which could be part of a mechanism that explains why when you're feeling, if you're upright, you feel like you can handle stuff. And if you're feeling slumped, then you feel sort of powerless and awful. And the good thing about being a human is that you can reverse engineer this and think, okay, I feel rubbish. Maybe if I sit up straight, that will make me feel a bit more like I'm capable, a bit more like I can do this today. And it's been shown in experiments that that's exactly what happens. When you give people a difficult task to do, you get them to write a talk that they have to present to people within 5 minutes, and they have a load of people sitting there watching, looking very unimpressed. That's a really stressful thing that reliably makes people, their blood pressure go up, their palms get sweaty, people hate it. People who have been upright posture beforehand recover more quickly from that stressful encounter than people who have been sat slumped beforehand. So there does seem to be something very important going on with our posture. But yeah, there's lots of other things coming out of this sort of embodied cognition research. So smiling has been shown to make you feel happier. So walking lightly on your feet has been shown to make you feel more positive. So there's all kinds of things. It's a fake it until you make it sort of situation. You know, if you feel awful, then making your body into a shape where you don't feel awful can sometimes trick your brain into thinking, oh, okay, the kind of the messages that are going into the brain are, that's fine, don't worry, everything's under control. And that can make things just feel a little bit better.
So with all this movement, there's a flip side to the coin, that's rest. How should we be thinking about rest?
Yeah, the interesting thing that I found about rest was that, you know, there's all these studies and statistics about how little we're moving, that we're spending all this time sedentary, but there's a parallel body of work into rest. And something like 60% of people that were surveyed came back and said they didn't feel that they were getting enough rest. So you can say that whatever we're doing with all this sedentary time, we're not finding it particularly restful. So, and to be able to move and have the energy to do that, you need to have rest. So they're two sides of the same coin. I think one interesting thing to remember with rest is it doesn't necessarily have to involve being sedentary. You know, rest can be running up a hill if it allows you to forget what's going on in your life and come back feeling happy and exhausted. You know, it can involve lying on the floor with your eyes closed and just tuning into your body and then thinking, okay, I do need to go for a walk, or I do need to jump up and down. Or it doesn't necessarily have to be flopping and putting the TV on and just getting out of your own head that way. So I think, yeah, rethinking rest as a sort of a partner to movement, I think is something that's really important, because I think there's a danger that you say, we all need to be moving more. People take that to mean, well, I should be going running twice a day rather than once. I should be going to the gym. I should be doing more. Actually, it's about little and often, and movement is not necessarily exercise. It can be exercise, but movement is so much more than that. And so I think it's a case of getting a bit of balance in our lives and not striving to wear ourselves out, because that won't be good for our minds either.
And that's a key point that I'm taking away from your book. Exercise is good, but going to the gym is simply not enough. What's your advice for people listening on how we can build more movement into our everyday lives?
Yeah, so there was a sort of slightly depressing for people who go to the gym study that looked at the health of people's brains over very long periods of time. And obviously, I'm not saying exercise and going to the gym is a bad thing. It's really not. But the correlation with sort of decline in brain health over long term was linked to the amount of time they were spending sedentary, regardless of whether they'd done exercise during the day as well. So it's not simply a case of sort of getting out of bed, you know, sitting at your desk for 4 hours, going for a mad run, coming back, sitting for another 4 hours. It's more about breaking up the sedentary time. So it doesn't have to involve anything particularly strenuous, just getting up, moving around. I met people who were interested in MoveNat, which is a form of movement where you move like a natural human. You carry, you climb, you run, you swim. You know, it's all kinds of sort of animal human based exercise. And they have this thing they call movement snacks. And so you get up every, I don't know, 20 minutes and you do some crawling around the room, or you hang from your door frame, or you lift something, and it doesn't have to be that prescribed, but just making time during the day to shift position, to move around, go downstairs, go upstairs, make sure you're stretching for things in a high cupboard rather than climbing on the nearest chair, just building, making a more conscious effort to get more movement into your day. So little and often, rather than guilting yourself into yet another form of exercise, yet another sort of class that you feel that you should do.
That is very helpful. I'm ready for a few movement snacks. So I've got some great ideas now.
Yeah.
Great memorable concept, little and often.
Absolutely. And, you know, I like the concept of snacks, because you think about eating snacks, they tend to add up over the course of the day and the year without you really noticing that you've had them, but they have an effect on your body in terms of eating snacks, not necessarily in a good way. But movement snacks can add up in a really healthy way, and you don't necessarily have to do that many changes to your lifestyle to squeeze them in. So yeah, I love the idea of movement snacks.
Caroline, thank you so much for taking the time. Great information, well-researched book. And there's a link to the book in our show notes and other information on you. Thanks again.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been lovely chatting.
It's time for takeaways. Here are three that jumped out to me, and I hope they'll spur your own list. Number one, don't decline in your seat. There are important physical consequences to a lack of movement, but there are also important mental ones. Less movement means more cognitive decline. So work in more movement in your day-to-day. Take care of your brain. Number two, going to the gym is great, but not enough. This was a big one for me, realizing that It's what you do with that sedentary time that really makes the difference. So break it up, break up the time that you inevitably do sit, and make sure you're working your movement along the way. That's certainly going to be a focus for me. And I'll be adding movement snacks to the menu. And third, remember the fundamentals. Listen to what your grandmother probably told you. Watch your posture and smile. Goes a long way, not only for others, but for you. Thanks so much for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast.
Just one more thing before you take off. Is it time to design your new life after you graduate from the world of full-time work? Go to retirementwisdom.com and schedule a call today with Joe Casey. Working with an experienced coach like Joe can help you explore new possibilities and gain clarity on your future. Thank you for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. See you next week.